And then I thought, what's a job that really needs someone with my talents? Said Ronnie. To me, time is just another direction. And then I thought, everyone wants fresh milk, yes? And everyone wants it delivered early in the morning.
Gotta be better than the window cleaning, said Lutzer.
I only went into that after they invented windows, said Ronnie. It was the gardening before that. More rancid yak butter?
Please, said Lutzer, holding out his cup. Lutzer was 800 years old, and that was why he was having a rest. A hero would have leaped up and rushed out into the silent city, and then... And there you had it. Then a hero would have had to wonder what to do next. 800 years had taught Lutzer that what happens, stays happened. It might stay happened in a different set of dimensions, if you wanted to get technical, but you couldn't make it unhappen. The clock had struck, and time had stopped. Later, a solution would present itself. In the meantime, a cup of tea and conversation with his serendipitous rescuer might speed that time. After all, Ronnie was not your average milkman. Lutzer had long considered that everything happens for a reason, except possibly football. It's the real stuff you got there, Ronnie, he said, taking a sip. The butter we are getting these days you wouldn't grease a cart with. It's the breed, said Ronnie. I go and get this from the Highland herd 600 years ago. Cheers, said Lutzer, raising his cup. Funny, though. I mean, if you said to people there were originally 5 horsemen of the apocalypse, then one of them left and became a milkman, well, they'd be a bit surprised. They'd wonder about why you... For a moment, Ronnie's eyes blazed silver. Creative differences, he growled. The whole ego thing. Some people might say... No, I don't like to talk about it. I wish them all the luck in the world, of course. Of course, said Lutzer, keeping his expression opaque. And I've watched their careers with great interest. I'm sure. You know I even got written out of the official history, said Ronnie. He held up a hand and a book appeared in it. It looked brand new. This was before, he said sourly. Book of Om, Prophecies of Tobrun. Ever meet him? Tall man, beard, tendency to giggle at nothing. Or before even my time, Ronnie. Ronnie handed the book over. First edition. Try chapter 2, verse 7, he said. And Lutzer read, And the angel, clothed all in white, opened the iron book. And the fifth rider appeared in a chariot of burning ice. And there was a snapping of laws and a breaking of bonds, and the multitudes cried, O God, we're in trouble now. That was me, said Ronnie proudly. Lutzer's eyes strayed to verse 8. And I saw, sort of like rabbits in many colours, but basically a plaid pattern, kind of spinning around, and there was a sound as of, like, big syrupy things. That verse got cut from the next edition, said Ronnie. Very open to visions of all sorts, old Tobrun. The fathers of Omnianism could pick and mix what they wanted. Of course, in those days, everything was new. Death was death, of course. But the rest were really just localized crop failure, scuffles and spots. And you? Lutzer ventured. Ah, the public wasn't interested in me anymore, said Ronnie. Or so I was told. Back in those days, we were only playing to very small crowds. One plague of locusts, some tribes, waterhole drying up, a volcano exploding. We were glad of any gig going. There wasn't room for 5. He sniffed. So I was told. Lutzer put down the cup. Well, Ronnie, it's been very nice talking to you, but time, well, time's not rushing, you see. Yeah, heard about that. The streets are full of the law. Ronnie's eyes blazed again. Law? Glang, the auditors. They've had the glass clock built again. You know that? Look, I might not be one of the fearsome 4, but I do keep my eyes and ears open, said Ronnie. But that's the end of the world. No, it's not, said Ronnie calmly. Everything's still here. But it's not going anywhere. Oh, well, that's not my problem, is it? Said Ronnie. I do milk and dairy products. Lutzer looked around the sparkling dairy, at the glistening bottles, at the gleaming churns. What a job for a timeless person. The milk would always be fresh. He looked back at the bottles, and an unbidden thought rose in his mind. Even the horsemen were people-shaped, and people are vain. Knowing how to use other people's vanity was a martial art all in itself, and Lutzer had been doing it for a long time. "I bet I can work out who you were," he said. "I bet I can work out your real name."
"Ha! Not a chance, monk," said Ronnie.
"Not a monk, just a sweeper," said Lutzer calmly.
"Just a sweeper."
"You called them the law, Ronnie."
"There has got to be a law, right? They make the rules, Ronnie. You've got to have rules, isn't that true?"
"I do milk and dairy products," said Ronnie. But a muscle twitched under his eye.
"Also eggs by arrangement. It's a good, steady business. I'm thinking of taking on more staff at the shop."
"Why?" said Lutzer. "There won't be anything for them to do."
"And expand the cheese side more," said Ronnie, not looking at the sweeper. "Big market for cheese. And I thought maybe I could get a C-mail address. People could send in orders. It could be a big market."
"All the rules are one, Ronnie. Nothing moves anymore. Nothing is unexpected because nothing happens."
Ronnie sat staring at nothing. "I can see you found your niche then, Ronnie," said Lutzer soothingly. "And you keep this place like a new pin. There's no doubt about it. I expect the rest of the lads will be really pleased to know that you're, you know, getting on all right. Just one thing, eh? Why did you rescue me?"
"What?" "Well, it was my charitable duty."
"You're the fifth horseman, Mr. Soak. Charitable duty?"
"Except," Lutzer thought, "you've been human-shaped a long time. You want me to find out. You want me to. Thousands of years of a life like this, it's curled you in on yourself. You'll fight me all the way, but you want me to drag your name out of you." Ronnie's eyes glowed.
"I'll look after my own sweeper."
"I'm one of yours, am I?"
"You have certain worthwhile points."
They stared at one another.
"I'll take you back to where I found you," said Ronnie Soap. "That's all. I don't do that other stuff anymore."
The auditor lay on its back, mouth open. Occasionally it made a weak little noise, like the whimper of a gnat.
"Try again, Mr. Doc Avocado, Mr. White. Is that a real color?"
"Yes, Mr. White," said Mr. Doc Avocado, who wasn't entirely sure that it was.
"Try again then, Mr. Doc Avocado."
Mr. Doc Avocado, with great reluctance, reached down toward the prone figure's mouth. Its fingers were a few inches away when, apparently of its own volition, the figure's left hand moved in a blur and gripped them. There was a crackle of bone.
"I feel extreme pain, Mr. White."
"What is in its mouth, Mr. Doc Avocado?"
"It appears to be cooked fermented grain product, Mr. White. The extreme pain is continuing."
"A foodstuff?"
"Yes, Mr. White. The sensations of pain are really quite noticeable at this point."
"Did I not give an order that there should be no eating or drinking or unnecessary experimentation with sensory apparatus?"
"Indeed you did, Mr. White. The sensation known as extreme pain, which I mentioned previously, is now really quite acute. What shall I do now?"
The concept of orders was yet another new and intensely unfamiliar one for any auditor. They were used to decisions by committee, reached only when the possibilities of doing nothing whatsoever about the matter in question had been exhausted. Decisions made by everyone were decisions made by no one, which therefore precluded any possibility of blame. But the bodies understood orders. This was clearly something that made humans human, and so the auditors went along with it in a spirit of investigation. There was no choice in any case. All kinds of sensations arose when they were given instructions by a man holding an edged weapon. It was surprising how smoothly the impulse to consult and discuss metamorphosed into a pressing desire to do what the weapon said.
"Can you not persuade him to let go of your hand?"
"He appears to be unconscious, Mr. White. His eyes are bloodshot. He is making a little sighing noise. Yet the body seems determined that the bread should not be removed. could I raise again the issue of the unbearable pain? Mr. White signaled to two other auditors. With considerable effort, they pried Mr. Dark Avocado's fingers loose.
This is something we will have to learn more about, said Mr. White. The renegade spoke of it. Mr. Dark Avocado?
Yes, Mr. White.
Do the sensations of pain persist?
My hand feels both hot and cold, Mr. White.
How strange, said Mr. White. I see that we will need to investigate pain in greater depth.
Mr. Dark Avocado found that a little voice in the back of his head screamed at the thought of this, while Mr. White went on.
What other foodstuffs are there? We know the names of 3,719 foods, said Mr. Indigo Violet, stepping forward.
He had become the expert on such matters, and this was another new thing for the auditors. They had never had experts before. What one knew, all knew. Knowing something that others did not know marked one as, in a small way, an individual. Individuals could die. But it also gave you power and value, which meant that you might not die quite so easily. It was a lot to deal with. And like some of the other auditors, he was already assembling a number of facial tics and twitches as his mind tried to cope.
Name one, said Mr. White.
Cheese, said Mr. Indigo.
It is rotten.
Snapped. Come on. Let's get through the museum. At least no one moves about much in there at the best of times. Ankh Morpork had not had a king for many centuries, but palaces tend to survive. A city might not need a king, but it can always use big rooms and some handy large walls, long after the monarchy is but a memory, and the building is renamed the Glorious Memorial to the People's Industry. Although the last king of the city was no oil painting himself, especially when he'd been beheaded, after which no one looks at their best, not even a short king, it was generally agreed that he had amassed some pretty good works of art. Even the common people of the city had a keen eye for works like Caravati's Three Large Pink Women and One Piece of Gauze, or Mauvez's Man with Big Fig Leaf. And besides, a city with a history the length of Ankh Morpork's accumulated all kinds of artistic debris, and in order to prevent congestion in the streets, needed some sort of civic attic in which to store it. And thus, at little more cost than a few miles of plush red rope and a few old men in uniform to give directions to Three Large Pink Women and One Piece of Gauze, the Royal Art Museum was born. Lobsang and Susan hurried through the silent halls. As with Fidgets, it was hard to know if time had stopped here. Its passage was barely perceptible in any case. The monks at Oi Dong considered it a valuable resource. Susan stopped, turned to look up at a huge gilt-framed picture that occupied one whole wall of a lengthy corridor, and said quietly,
"Oh, what is it?"
"The Battle of Argash by Blitzed," said Susan. Lobsang looked at the flaking, uncleaned paint and the yellow-brown varnish. The colors had faded to a dozen shades of mud, but something violent and evil shone through.
"Is that meant to be hell?" he said.
"No. It was an ancient city in Klatch, thousands of years ago, said Susan. But Grandfather did say that men made it hell. Blitzt went mad when he painted it. He did good storm clouds, though, said Lobsang, swallowing. It's wonderful, the light. Look at what's coming out of the clouds, said Susan. Lobsang squinted into the crusted cumulus and fossilized lightning. Oh, yes, the four horsemen. You often get them in Count Again, said Susan. Lobsang stared. There's two of them. Oh, don't be silly, there's five, she began, and then followed his gaze. He hadn't been interested in the art. A couple of auditors were hurrying away from them toward the porcelain room. They're running away from us, said Lobsang. Susan grabbed his hand. Not exactly, she said. They always consult. There has to be three of them to do that. And they'll be back, so come on. She grabbed his hand and towed him into the next gallery. There were gray figures at the far end. The pair ran on, past dust-encrusted tapestries, and into another huge, ancient room. Ye gods! There's a picture of three huge, pink women with only... Lobsang began as he was dragged past. Pay attention, will you? The way to the main door was back there. This place is full of auditors. But it's just an old art gallery. There's nothing for them here, is there? They slid to a stop on the marble slabs. A wide staircase led up to the next floor. We'll be trapped up there, said Lobsang. There's balconies all around, said Susan. Come on! She dragged him up the stairs and through an archway and stopped. The galleries were several stories high. On the second floor, visitors could look down onto the floor below, and, in the room below, the auditors were very busy. What the hell are they doing now? Whispered Lobsang. I think, said Susan grimly, that they are appreciating art.
Miss Tangerine was annoyed. Her body kept making strange demands of her, and the work with which she had been entrusted was going so very badly. The frame of what once had been Sir Robert Cuspidor's wagon stuck in river was leaning against a wall in front of her. It was empty. The bare canvas was neatly rolled beside it. In front of the frame, carefully heaped in order of size, were piles of pigment. Several dozen auditors were breaking these down into their component molecules. Still nothing, she said, striding along the line. No, Miss Tangerine, only known molecules and atoms so far, said an auditor, its voice shaking slightly. Well, is it something to do with the proportions, the balance of molecules, the basic geometry? We are continuing to get on with it. The other auditors in the gallery clustered industriously in front of what had once been a painting, and in fact still was, insofar as every single molecule was still present in the room, glanced up and then bent again to their tasks. Miss Tangerine was getting even angrier because she couldn't work out why she was angry. One reason was probably that, when he gave her this task, Mr. White had looked at her in a funny way. Being looked at was an unfamiliar experience for an auditor in any case. No auditor bothered to look at another auditor very often, because all auditors looked the same, and neither were they used to the idea that you could say things with your face, or even have a face, or have a body that reacted in strange ways to the expression on another face belonging to, in this case, Mr. White. When he looked at her like that, she felt a terrible urge to claw his face off, which made absolutely no sense at all. No auditor should feel like that about another auditor. No auditor should feel like that about anything. No auditor should feel. She felt livid. They'd all lost so many powers. It was ridiculous to have to communicate by flapping bits of your skin. And as for the tongue, yuck! As far as she knew, in the whole life of the universe, no auditor had ever experienced the sensation of yuck. This wretched body was full of opportunities for yuck. She could leave it at any time, and yet, part of her didn't want to. There was this horrible desire, second by second, to hang on. And she felt hungry. And that also made no sense. The stomach was a bag for digesting food. It wasn't supposed to issue commands. The auditors could survive quite well by exchanging molecules with their surroundings and making use of any local source of energy. That was a fact. Try telling that to the stomach. She could feel it. It was sitting there, grumbling. She was being harassed by her internal organs. Why had they copied internal organs? Yuck! Oh, it was all too much. She wanted to express herself by shouting some terrible words. Discord! Confusion! The other auditors looked around in terror. But the words just didn't work for Miss Tangerine. They just didn't have the same force that they used to. There had to be something worse. Ah, yes. Organs! She shouted, pleased to have found it at last. And what are all you organs looking at? She added. Get on with it!
They're taking everything apart, whispered Lobsang.
That's the auditors for you, said Susan. They think that's how you find out about things. You know, I really loathe them. I really do.
Lobsang glanced sideways at her. The monastery was not a single-sex institution. That is to say, it was. But corporately, it had never thought of itself like that, because the possibility of females working there had never crossed even minds capable of thinking in 16 dimensions at once. But the Thieves Guild had recognized that girls were, at least as good as boys, in all areas of thieving. He had, for example, fond memories of his classmate, Steph, who could steal the small change out of your back pocket and climb better than an assassin. He was at home around girls, but Susan scared the life out of him. It was as if some secret place inside her boiled with wrath, and with the auditors, she let it out. He remembered her hitting that one with her wrench. There had been just a faint frown of concentration, as if she was making certain the job was done properly. "Shall we go?" he ventured.
"Look at them," said Susan.
"Only an auditor would take a picture apart to see what made it a work of art."
"There's a big pile of white dust over there," said Lobsang.
"Man with huge fig leaf," said Susan absently, her eyes still intent on the gray figures.
"They dismantle a clock to search for the tick."
"How do you know it's man with huge fig leaf? I just happened to remember where it was, that's all."
You appreciate art?" Lobsang ventured.
"I know what I like," said Susan, still staring at the busy gray figures. "And right now, I'd like quite a lot of weaponry."
"We'd better move. The bastards get into your head if you let them," said Susan, not moving.
"When you find yourself thinking, there ought to be a law, or I don't make the rules after all, or
I really think we should leave," said Lobsang carefully. "And I think this because there are some of them coming up the stairs."
Her head jerked around.
"What are you standing about for, then?" she said.
They ran through the next arch and into a gallery of pottery, turning to look only when they reached the far end. Three auditors were following them. They weren't running, but there was something about their synchronized step that had a horrible, "we'll keep on coming" quality.
"All right, let's go this way."
"No, let's go this way," said Lobsang.
"That's not the way we need to go," Susan snapped.
"No, but the sign up there says arms and armor." So, are you any good with weapons?
No, said Lobsang proudly, and then realized she'd taken this the wrong way.
Well, you see, I've been taught to fight without... Maybe there's a sword I can use, Susan growled and strode forward.
By the time the auditors entered the gallery, there were more than three of them. The gray crowd paused.
Susan had found a sword, part of a display of Agatian armor. It had been blunted by disuse, but anger flared along the blade.
Should we keep running? Said Lobsang.
No, they always catch up. I don't know if we can kill them here, but we can make them wish we could.
You still haven't got a weapon?
No, because you see, I've been trained to...
Just keep out of my way then, okay?
The auditors advanced cautiously, which struck Lobsang as odd.
We can't kill them, said Lobsang.
It depends on how alive they've let themselves become.
But they look scared, he said.
They're human-shaped, said Susan over her shoulder. Human bodies, perfect copies. Human bodies have had thousands and thousands of years of not wanting to be cut in half. That kind of leaks into the brain, don't you think?
And then the auditors were circling and moving in. Of course, they would all attack at once. No one would want to be first. Three made a grab at Lobsang. He'd enjoyed the fighting back in the training dojos. Of course, everyone was padded, and no one was actually trying to kill you, and that helped. But Lobsang had done well because he was good at slicing. He could always find that extra edge, and if you had that edge, you didn't need quite so much skill. There was no edge here. There was no time to slice. He adopted a mixture of snafu and okidoki, and anything that worked, because you were dead if you treated a real fight like the dojo. The gray men were no contest, in any case. They just attempted to grab and hug. A granny could fend them off. He sent two reeling, and turned to the third, which was trying to grab him around the neck. He broke the hold, spun around ready to chop, and hesitated.
Oh, good grief, said a voice.
Susan's blade whirled past Lobsang's face. The head in front of him was parted from its former body in a shower not of blood, but of colored, floating dust. The body evaporated, became very briefly a gray, robed shape in the air, and vanished. Lobsang heard a couple of thumps behind him, and then Susan grabbed his shoulder.
You're not supposed to hesitate, you know, she said. But it was a woman.
It was not.
But it was the last one. Now let's go before the rest get here.
She nodded at the second group of auditors that were watching them very carefully from the end of the hall.
Well, they weren't much of a contest anyway, said Lobsang, getting his breath. What are those doing?
Learning. Can you fight better than that?
Of course.
Good, because the next time they'll be as good as you just were.
Where to now?
This way.
The next gallery was full of stuffed animals. There'd been a vogue for it a few centuries before. These weren't the sad old hunting trophy bears or geriatric tigers whose claws had faced a man armed with nothing more than 5 crossbows, 20 loaders, and 100 beaters. Some of these animals were arranged in groups. Quite small groups. Of quite small animals. There were frogs seated around a tiny dining table. There were dogs dressed in hunting jackets in pursuit of a fox wearing a cap with feathers in it. There was a monkey playing a banjo.
Oh, no! It's an entire band, said Susan in tones of horrified astonishment. And just look at the little kittens dancing.
Horrible.
I wonder what happened when the man who did this met my grandfather.
Would he have met your grandfather?
Oh, yes, said Susan. Oh, yes. And my grandfather is rather fond of cats.
Lobsang paused at the foot of a staircase, half hidden behind a luckless elephant. A red rope, now hard as a bar, suggested that this wasn't part of the public museum. There was an added hint in the shape of a notice saying, "Absolutely no admittance."
"I should be up there," he said.
"Let's not hang around then, eh?" said Susan, leaping over the rope. The narrow stairs led up into a large, bare landing. Boxes were stacked here and there. "The attics," said Susan. "Hold on. What's that sign for?"
"Keep left," Lobsang read.
"Well, if they have to move heavy items around..."
"Look at the sign, will you?" said Susan. "Don't see what you expect to see. See what's in front of you."
Lobsang looked. "Keep left," pointing to the right.
"What a stupid sign," he said.
"Interesting, certainly," said Susan. "Which way do you think we should go? I don't think it'll take them too long to decide to follow us."
"We're so close. Any passage might do," said Lobsang.
"Any passage it is, then." Susan headed for a narrow gap between packing cases. Lobsang followed.
"What do you mean, decide?" he said as they entered the gloom.
"The sign on the stairs said there was no admittance."
"You mean they'll disobey it?"
He stopped.
"Eventually. But they'll have a terrible feeling that they ought not to. They obey rules. They are the rules, in a way.
But you can't obey the keep left, right sign, no matter what you do."
"Oh, I see. Isn't learning fun?"
"Oh, and here's another one. Do not feed the elephant."
"Now that," said Susan, "is good.
You can't obey it."
"Because there's no elephant," said Lobsang. "I think I'm getting the hang of this."
"It's an auditor trap," said Susan, peering at a packing case.
"Oh, here's another good one," said Lobsang.
"Ignore this sign. By order."
"Nice touch," Susan agreed.
"But I'm wondering, who put up the signs?"
There were voices. Someone behind them. They were low, but then one was suddenly raised.
"Says left but points right. It has no sense. The fault is yours. We disobeyed the first sign. Woe to them that stray onto the pathway of irregularity. Don't you give me that, you organic thing. I raise my voice at you, you..."
There was a soft sound, a choking noise, and a scream that dopplered into nothing.
"Are they fighting one another?" said Lobsang. "We can only hope so. Let's move," said Susan.
They crept on, weaving through a maze of spaces between the crates, and past a sign saying, "Duck."
"Ah, now we're getting metaphysical," said Susan.
"Why duck?" said Lobsang.
"Why indeed?"
Somewhere among the cases, a voice reached the end of its tether.
"What organic damn elephant? Where is the elephant?"
"There is no elephant."
"How can there be a sign, then? It is a..."
And once again, the little choke and the vanishing scream. And then, running footsteps. Susan and Lobsang backed into the shadows, and then Susan said,
"What have I put my foot in?"
She reached down and picked up the soft, sticky mess. And as she rose, she saw the auditor coming around the corner. It was wild-eyed and frantic. It focused on the pair of them with difficulty, as if trying to remember who and what they were, but it was holding a sword, and holding it correctly. A figure rose up behind it. One hand grabbed it by the hair and jerked back its head. The other was thrust over its open mouth. The auditor struggled for a moment, and then went rigid. And then disintegrated, tiny particles spinning away and disappearing into nothing. For a moment, the last few handfuls tried to form, in the air, the shape of a small, cowled figure. Then it, too, was dragged apart, with a faint scream that was heard via the hairs on the back of the neck. Susan glared at the figure in front of her.
You're a... Well, you can't be a... What are you? She demanded.
The figure was silent. This may have been because thick cloth covered its nose and mouth. Heavy gloves encased its hands, too. And this was odd, because most of the rest of it was wearing a sequined evening gown, and a mink stole, and a knapsack, and a huge picture hat with enough feathers to make three rare species totally extinct. The figure rummaged in the knapsack, and then thrust out a piece of dark brown paper, as if proffering holy writ. Lobsang took it with care.
It says here, Higgs and Meekin's luxury assortment, he said. Caramel crunch, hazelnut surprise. They're chocolate.
Susan opened her hand and looked at the crushed strawberry whirl she had picked up. She gave the figure a careful look.
How did you know that would work? She said. Please, you have nothing to fear from me, said the muffled voice through the bandages. I'm down to the ones with the nuts in now, and they don't melt very quickly.
Sorry, said Lobsang. You just killed an auditor with a chocolate.
My last orange cream, yes. We are exposed here. Come with me.
An auditor, Susan breathed.
You're an auditor too, aren't you? Why should I trust you? There isn't anyone else. But you are one of them, said Susan. I can tell, even under all that stuff. I was one of them, said Lady Lejeune. Now I rather think I'm one of me.
People were living in the attic. There was a whole family up there. Susan wondered if their presence was official or unofficial, or one of those in-between states that were so common in Ankh-Morpork, where there was always a chronic housing shortage. So much of the city's life took place on the street because there was no room for it inside. Whole families were raised in shift, so that the bed could be used for 24 hours a day. By the look of it, the caretakers and men who knew the way to Caravati's three large pink women and one piece of gauze had moved their families into the rambling attics. The rescuer had simply moved in on top of them. A family, or at least one shift of it, was seated on benches around a table, frozen in timelessness. Lady Lejeune removed her hat, hung it on the mother, and shook out her hair. Then she unwrapped the heavy bandages from her nose and mouth. They revealed an exquisite mask of a face that had nevertheless been made up by a clown. Probably a blind clown, and one who was wearing boxing gloves. In a fog. The woman looked at the world through panda eyes, and her lipstick touched her mouth only by accident. She looked down when she caught Susan's stare.
I know what I look like, she said. I'm afraid I'm losing control. I'm sorry. There's just too much. It's all too... Ever since I just feel so...
She stopped and attempted to pull herself together.
My name is Miria Lejeune. I know you, Susan Stowe-Helite. I do not know the young man, although there is something familiar about him. I take it you are here to destroy the clock.
To stop it, said Lobsang.
Hold on, said Susan. This makes no sense. Auditors hate everything about life. And you are an auditor, aren't you?
I have no idea what I am, sighed Lady Lejeune. but right now I know that I am everything an auditor should not be. We have to be stopped.
With chocolate? Said Susan.
The sense of taste is new to us. Alien. We have no defenses.
But chocolate? A dry toast almost killed me, said her ladyship.
Susan, can you imagine what it is like to experience taste for the first time? We built our bodies well. Oh, yes, lots of taste buds. Even water is like wine. But chocolate? Even the mind stops. There is nothing but the taste, she sighed. I imagine it is a wonderful way to die.
It doesn't seem to affect you, said Susan suspiciously.
The bandages and the gloves, said Lady Lejeune. Even then, it is all I can do not to give in. Oh, where are my manners? Do sit down. Pull up a small child.
Lobsang and Susan exchanged a glance. Lady Lejeune noticed it.
I said something wrong, she said.
We don't use people as furniture, said Susan.
Oh, but surely they will not be aware of it, said her ladyship.
We will, said Lobsang. That's the point, really.
Oh, I have so much to learn. There is so much context to being human, I'm afraid. You, sir, can you stop the clock?
I don't know how to, said Lobsang. But I think I should know. I'll try.
Would the clockmaker know? He is here.
Where? Said Susan.
Just down the passage, said Lady Lejeune.
You carried him here?
Well, he was barely able to walk. He was hurt badly in the fight.
What? Said Lobsang.
How could he walk at all? We're outside time.
Susan took a deep breath. He carries his own time, just like you, she said. He's your brother. And it was a lie. But he wasn't ready for the truth. By the look of his face, he wasn't even ready for the lie.
End of side 12.